I get to what I want to talk about, just a couple prefatory notes about these readings, because I think we have a long history in the Christian church to read these biblical texts in a way that's really a misreading of them. For instance, the issue here in this thing from Chronicles seems to lay out this nice kind of moral calculus. The Jews misbehave, God knocks them alongside of the head. They don't be faithful, so God sends the Babylonians as his agent. That is clearly a theological reading of whatever happened in that time. And that nice moral calculus, you remember, is absolutely undercut, destroyed, obliterated by later Jewish thought, which we find in the book of Job, which means that there is no kind of cause and effect relationship between how people behave and how they suffer in life. So that's really important, because we're going to come up to Good Friday and we're going to talk about the cross, and we've got to know what the cross is. God does not punish in the normal sense of the word. God just says, well, you guys are free, so you do what you do and then see what happens. In the same way, you have this kind of punitive sense in the Gospel of John, which is certainly read, I mean, much beloved of the televangelists. Whoever believes in him will not be condemned, but whoever does not believe has already been condemned. Please note that the whole Johannine version of this is that Jesus is understood as the light. And so if you shut down the light, you're not being condemned by God or punished by God. You simply decide not to see. And not seeing, therefore you're blind. And in that extent, you're condemned. But again, you don't have to invoke God's kind of response to people's obtuseness. Because the whole development of Jewish thought, epitomized in Jesus, is precisely God never gives up on people, despite their obtuseness. Okay, now back to this do-it-yourself wilderness creation kit that I've been trying to suggest during Lent. So we talked about silence, talked about too great busyness, a pace, which is basically distracting and simply spreads us all over the place, helping us to lose focus. I'd like to suggest another crucial element in the wilderness. The wilderness is what? Basically, the attempt to dislocate yourself, to take yourself out of this place, this locus, where you're comfortable, where you know everything, where you're safe, where you're secure, and relocate yourself to where someplace where all those props, those buttressing elements in your life disappear. Not for the sake of just being miserable and lost, but rather for the sake of transforming, so that we can transform our understanding of who we are, apart from all those props and buttresses. To see ourselves, as the scripture says, over and over, as God sees us, in other words. And that's basically what the wilderness is for. Whether it's the official wilderness of the Egyptian desert in the 3rd century, or Benedict of Nursia's desert on Monte Cassino in Italy in the 6th century, it is a constant of the Christian experience. We have to have this wilderness experience. We have to more and more come to the conviction that we live in a wilderness. Otherwise, there's no room for God. So, silence is crucial to that. Not being so wrapped up and engaged and absorbed by our agendas is crucial to that too. Today I'd like to suggest that poverty is absolutely essential to that. That dislocation. I should not have to make a case for the centrality of poverty in Jesus' view of things. Foxes have holes. The birds of the air have nests. The Son of Man has nowhere to lay his hand. Head. The Lilies of the Field, besides being the title of a nice movie, is precisely drawing people's attention to the fact that, you know, all this, people do not have to own a lot of stuff to be cared for by God. In fact, owning a lot of stuff is precisely an obstruction to the awareness that we are cared for by God. That's the point. Because as I've been thinking about this for the last couple of weeks, I walk into my little house, there are my little dogs, there are my big book collection, there are my CD collection, there's my African art, I'm home. I know who I am, because I know where I am, because I know what I own. And poverty becomes a real issue in that moment of awareness. Because too much of my sense of who I am is determined by what I own. And until I impoverish myself, that other self, that more authentic self to which the Gospels constantly call us, to which Jesus constantly called people, put down your nets and follow me. Go sell everything you own, give the money to the poor, and then you can be my disciple. Remember that terrifying interview between, or conversation between Jesus and the so-called rich young man? Somehow we have to bring that off, or we have to more modestly be aware that we must bring that off somehow, in some way. The easiest way, I think, historically, from not just my own autobiography, but from everybody I know, is to go live in a third world country. Not everybody can do that. Go live in Mexico. Go live in Haiti. Go live virtually any place in Africa. Go to Pakistan. Go to China. In the boonies. And everybody I know who's had that experience has returned with this enormous knot in their gut. They walk into Loblaws and find 52 kinds of mustard on the grocery shelf. There's this terrible, terrible sense of dissonance. Now, it's inarticulate, I grant you, for the most part. We don't know what to do. The bad feeling is there, but until the shape of that and the nature of that feeling is brought to consciousness, it's just going to evaporate, like all bad feelings do sooner or later. What is necessary is to become powerfully aware of the other pole of that consciousness that was inescapable when somebody was in a third world country, namely these other people. These others. And so the existence in my consciousness of the others is absolutely essential first step to the notion of real poverty. They are upright bipeds just like I am. They are my, and if you stay in a third world country long enough, you really will come to say, genuinely, they are my sisters, they are my brothers, they are my family. So, how does one transport the third world . One way, an initial step, is simply to look at the exuberance of our possessions. I think that's one way to start. But even that is only an inchoate step. You know, only that's a beginning. Because, again, you're not going to see, I'm not going to see the exuberance of my possessions until that polar other is there as well. Because exuberance is relative. Poverty is relative. Wealth is relative, as we all know. And so, I think that a second step after the awareness of that is attempt to disencumber, to simplify one's life. And this is horrifically difficult to do in North America. I'm finishing up the religion and media course, wherein the point is made by all the commentators on this stuff. We see 3,000 ads a day. 3,000 ads a day. You watch, and the London buses go by. And you're invited to buy this. It's inescapable. It's more immediate to us than our skins. Namely, this message that who we are is purchasable. And that's the critical thing. Who we are is purchasable. And the most overt form of that, of course, is the so-called, I don't know what they're called, vanity shirts, where Tommy Hilfiger, I'm a Tommy girl, you know, I'm a Tommy boy, or Pierre Cardin, or all the rest of it, whooshes on my feet. And the $195 price tag implicit, not only in my head, but in the head of everybody, sees the whoosh. But I think, and here I have to go back to a passage I read several years ago in this setting from a book by a Belgian theologian who worked in Brazil for a long time, José Comblain, and his magnificent book called Call to Freedom, in which, if you recall, he said, it is only when the poor become real for us that we can say we have heard the gospel. I have never heard it put so clearly, so succinctly. It is only when the poor become real to us that we've heard the gospel. And we have to be careful. Not poor as objects of our pity or sympathy or some vague sense of malaise, but only as our fellow human beings. Only then have we heard the gospel. That's ferocious. That's ferocious. Only when the poor become real to us have we heard the gospel. So let me finish by making yet another suggestion. And this is partly due to a talk that Ian gave at college a number of years ago. Imagine, as your partner in life, a black, female, handicapped, homosexual woman. An absolute five-time loser. Black, poor, handicapped, homosexual woman. Let her live with you, with me. Ask how the world looks to her, how she would write history. Go back to Ian's talk. What history would look like to her. And then, I think, we can move further toward creating this wilderness, which is not expendable. The wilderness is not a luxury. The wilderness is a sine qua non, is an absolute necessity in the following of Jesus.